Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's internet seminar, Pore Water Concentrations and Bioavailability, How You Can Measure Them and Why They Influence Contaminated Sediment Remediation. This is Session 3, Metals and Passive Sampling Devices. This webinar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program, as well as NARPM Presents, and was previously held as a course at the 2014 National Association for Remedial Project Managers Training Program meeting. My name is Michael Adam, and I'm with US EPA's Technology Integration and Information Branch. I'll be moderating this session. We'll get started in a few moments, and while we wait for everybody to log on, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is in the front page of today's webinar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note, the presenters' email addresses are hot-linked on the page in case you have any questions for them after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the limited number of phone lines, your phone lines were automatically put on mute when you joined the call. We request that you keep your phone on mute for the seminar. We will have allotted times for questions and answers, at which point you are welcome to take your phone off mute and ask the question by pressing #6 to unmute your phone. And after asking your question, please put your phone back on mute. I will remind you during the Q&A sessions on how to mute and unmute your phone. And this will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also remember to please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. Again, keep us on mute and do not put us on hold. By now, all of you should be joined to the Adobe Connect meeting room and should see a number of windows or pods within the room, which include the presentation materials. Slide number 1 of the presentation should be visible. And now move over to our housekeeping slide. If you have problems viewing the slides or shared content, you may click the full screen button in the upper right corner of the shared slide window to expand the content. To shrink it back down to normal size, simply press full screen again. If you experience other technical issues with Adobe Connect, you may be able to download a portion of the items that would be covered and follow along manually. Please note we cannot confirm that all portions of the seminar will be available. The majority of our participants will be listening to the presentation audio online through Adobe Connect. If you have problems with the audio, please check your own PC speakers or headphones. If you are on the phone lines, you may need to turn off your computer speakers or the online audio to eliminate duplicate broadcasts and feedback. You may submit questions by using the Q&A pod in the lower right corner. You do not need to wait until the Q&A period to submit your questions. We encourage you to submit in advance of the Q&A session. Please note questions will only be visible to the host. Other participants will not be able to view your questions. At the appropriate time for Q&A, the moderator will read the questions out loud to be answered by the presenters. If you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us to technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we'll try to help you troubleshoot your problem. You may also contact our technical support directly at 301-589-5318. Again, that number, 301-589-5318. At the end of our presentation, we will walk you through our related URLs pod, where we have assembled information that is directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. You will automatically receive an email once the archive is available. Associated with the related URLs pod is an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online seminar feedback form. And we do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You may also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. So with that, we're ready to start today's presentation. Let me remind you once more to keep your phones on mute, and again, do not put us on hold. So with that, I'll go ahead and introduce today's speakers. Today's first presentation, our first presenter today, is Mark Cantwell of EPA's Office of Research and Development. He received a BA in Environmental Science from the State University of New York and an MS and PhD in Oceanography from the University of Rhode Island. His research efforts at EPA primarily focus on contributions to better understand the bioavailability of contaminants, primarily in sediments and sediment interstitial waters. He has contributed to EPA's Superfund research effort to better understand the risk associated with contaminated sediments at Superfund sites. This has involved working for many years with OSRD staff to present research findings and to advance our understanding of the effects of metals and organic contaminants in aquatic systems. He's been awarded 2 bronze medals for contributing to a guidance document and reports with the sediments TIE writing group and the passive sampling of SAM's guidance document team. So with that, I'll turn today's presentation over to Mark.
Thank you, Mike, Justin, for putting this together, and everybody for joining in today. So I'm going to be talking about sediment pore waters and dissolved metals. And just a brief outline of what I'm going to be speaking to today. I'm going to give an introduction, rationale, and a background, and why we want to measure pore water metals and sediments. Give some insight into how metals behave in sediments, their interstitial waters, and why. And pardon me if I go kind of maybe back and forth and use the term sediment pore water and interstitial water interchangeably. I'll try and refrain from saying interstitial water, but it's kind of been hardwired into my brain. Next, give some general considerations for pore water sampling, looking at different methods and basically matching sites and the appropriate methods along with the desired outcomes. I'll present some common sampling methods that I've used over the years, both in situ and ex situ methods, some basic designs on them and their features, and also, more importantly, their limitations and where we may not want to use certain types of sampling methods or protocols. And then finally, go through pore water extraction and preservation techniques for keeping your sediment pore waters good before you actually get to measure them. So at many of the Superfund sites I worked at across the country, as well as many non-Superfund sites, sediments are still the primary source of contamination after discharges, releases to the environment have stopped. In contrast to organic contaminants, metals are unique in that they are an element and therefore they don't really degrade or decay, and their longevity poses unique challenges for on-site remediation and consequently the remediation managers. When metals are in sediment, a sediment's characteristics are very important for controlling and maintaining changes in the metals in the sediment, and ultimately this affects their dissolved metal concentration and speciation in the pore water. It's important to note that physical, biological, and chemical variables in the sediment can influence the state and speciation of the metals. Sediment toxicity for metals can change over very short periods of time due to changes in the sediment due to the physical, biological, chemical state. We kind of like to measure pore water metal concentrations because they do provide important information on the overall behavior of the metals at that location and the potential risk for metals at that site. Interstitial pore water concentrations are good to predict the general bioavailability to sediment-dwelling organisms. They are much better than using bulk metal measurements, which really don't provide us very good indications of the potential toxicity of metals when they're sediment bound. Important note for this discussion and many others with regard to pore water metals, we operationally define them as those that pass through a 0.45 micron filter. I have a little footnote here. It's important to note also that especially in interstitial or sediment pore waters, that colloids may be present, and therefore the metals may be associated with these, and that can also affect their potential bioavailability. So first I'd like to talk about physical factors that affect dissolved metal behavior and ultimately the concentrations in sediments. Many sites where metal contamination is an issue have conditions that present challenges to accurately measuring pore water metals. I'm here at AED Narragansett on the east coast of the United States, and a lot of the sites that we work at are tidally influenced that have currents, but there are also many locations such as that have streams and rivers with flow regimes that may erode, transport, and also deposit superficial sediments, keeping things in a relatively high state of flux. Sediment resuspension is also a important factor when you're trying to measure pore water concentrations. Sediment resuspension upset the surface of the sediment, affecting the redox potential discontinuity boundaries, and also irrigating sediments, changing the chemical status over very short periods of time. I have a slide in here of sediment-water interface. Biology does matter, especially at a lot of our coastal sites. We have biological processes such as bioturbation, which leads to irrigation at the sediment-water interface. So we get water transport across the sediment-water interface, bringing dissolved metals up across that boundary, also bringing water down. We also get translocation of contaminated sediment that might have been either capped or buried by clean sediment, overall contributing to transfer of contaminants by biological processes. These are also mostly driven by the species assemblage that's present at the location and their abundance. In this slide here, which I've borrowed and modified from Dominic DeToro, we look at the major chemical interactions that affect sediment pore water metals. On the left side, I have the binding phases that are relatively high priority when we're dealing with metals and sediments. And moving down the list, sediment organic carbon, the quantity is important, and that's been used in a number of calculations to determine pore water bioavailability. I also put in iron oxyhydroxides. Depending on the redox state of your sediment, they will have an important factor on controlling your dissolved metal concentrations. Anoxic sediments, these are an important binding phase, but as sediments become more reduced, the metals that may be co-precipitated with iron oxyhydroxides become solubilized and go into solution. Clay is another important substrate because of its surface area, but also you'll see in a lot of cases surface coating of organic matter and also other materials that will bind large quantities of metal. Not to be forgotten are also acid volatile sulfides. These bind large quantities of metal, primarily the divalent cationic metals such as cadmium, copper, nickel, and so forth. Acid volatile sulfides are also unique that depending on the metal being bound by the sulfide and their solubility products, you can get metal substitution. So Chris, who is the second speaker here, is going to be talking about mercury. You can actually have displacement reaction for metals that have a lower KSP displace metals that have a higher solubility product with respect to sulfides. So in this diagram, I also have the arrows that go back and forth between the sediment phases and the pore water metals. So depending on the conditions of the sediment, you will see metals potentially going from dissolved phase into the solid phase and back across depending on the conditions. Now I have the other arrow that shows the important ions that may be present in your pore water, and these, depending on which metal is of interest, will have an impact on the dissolved metal concentration of that metal. So now to talk about the RPD boundary or redox potential discontinuity boundary. It's a very important zone with respect to how it controls sediment condition and ultimately our sediment pore water concentrations. It's a vertical zonation that transitions vertically from oxic to anoxic depending on the sediment. It varies greatly from site, so you may have a lightly reduced site where you may have an RPD boundary that is maybe several centimeters below the surface of the sediment to one where it may be millimeters below the surface. It's usually distinguished by visual changes in color, going from a lighter oxidized color moving down to darker colors. This visual cue usually coincides with major changes in the sediment chemistry. This is redox driven, so as oxygen declines, we see a transition from an oxidized state to more reduced states where we see different substances such as CO2 reducing to methane, sulfates to hydrogen sulfide, and nitrates to ammonia. As you can imagine, this results in large and rapid changes to the sediment phases responsible for binding the metals. If the sum of the metals present exceed the sediment binding capacity, we may see metals present in the pore water. In this slide here, I'll just briefly discuss some of the more commonly measured pore water metals. Among them are the cationic divalent metals, cadmium, copper, nickel, lead, and zinc. I also have in here silver and chrome. The behavior of all these metals has been relatively well documented in the scientific literature, and there are numerous EPA documents that discuss them, and there are guidelines for assessing metals in the environment in a number of these publications. I also have included iron and manganese because of their potential and their redox sensitivity to precipitate metals from the dissolve phase. They're something that you want to keep in consideration as well. I also included relevant sediment measurements as you go forth and start measuring sediment pore waters. The sediment bulk chemistry is a very, very important consideration. At the top of the list is the acid volatile sulfides. As I mentioned, these can bind metals, particularly the divalent ones. And depending on the oxic state of your sediment, they can rapidly release these metals to the dissolve phase. Sediment organic carbon. Also important is the oxidation state of the sediment, which can be easily measured with a probe. pH is a master variable when you're dealing with metals in the environment, so the pH state of your sediment and interstitial water is critically important. When I was speaking previously about colloids, knowing what your DOC concentrations in your pore water can potentially give you insights as to how much of an issue colloidal associated metals may be. And finally, grain size, that just gives you a good physical characterization of your sediment. While this talk is primarily focused on metals, I also wanted to discuss real briefly a couple non-metals, and that being ammonia and hydrogen sulfide. These chemicals are naturally occurring in sediments, and based on their characteristics, they can be toxic to both aquatic and benthic-dwelling organisms. We've done a lot of work here measuring pore water toxicity over the years, and the presence of ammonia and hydrogen sulfide can cause complications in interpreting pore water toxicity if they are present. The good news is that both of these compounds can be easily measured in extracted pore waters using ion-specific electrodes. So if one of your goals is to assess interstitial water toxicity, you may want to be prepared to address the presence of ammonia and hydrogen sulfide in your sediments. So now moving forth into our sampling approaches, I think before going forward, you need to really determine the scope of your project, what your scientific or engineering goals are for measuring in pore water, what kind of budgets you're going to have to work with, and that's going to really drive a lot of how you're going to approach measuring pore water. Equally important is understanding your site characteristics, the size, the depth, currents, what kind of sediment types are you working with, what the contaminated sediment distributions around your site, and a multitude of actually other factors that will drive really how you're going to sample your pore water. The volume of sample that you require, depending on what you're measuring, if it's purely chemical measurements, you're going to probably be able to get away with less pore water than if you're going to try and do chemical toxicity tests, and that's going to drive what kind of samples you're going to have. Then, depending on a lot of the above, you're going to select a in situ or ex situ sampling method, and this is driven really by how much pore water you want and the site characteristics, whether or not you can sample by in situ methods. And then finally, field sampling design, the number of sampling sites that you want to hit and how often you want to follow them up. So first I'm going to talk about in situ samplers. I'm going to talk and address PEEPers or dialysis membrane samplers. A new entry to in situ samplers called rhizone samplers, tube samplers, otherwise known as Henry samplers, and I've thrown in lysimeters here, although they're not really used for sediments and more for terrestrial approaches. I've used them previously with good results for those of you that might have to collect soil pore waters from terrestrial sites. So PEEPers or dialysis membranes are really the only true metal-based passive sampling device. We insert these into sediments at a range of depths. Pore water enters a chamber through a filter membrane, which is generally somewhere in the size range of like 0.2 to 0.45 micron. And what happens basically is the sediment pore water passes through this membrane, and at the same time the passive sampler has usually deionized, deaerated water in it, and that exchanges with the sediment pore water. Consequently, there's an equilibration period associated with this that, over extensive testing that we've done over the years, takes about 14 days to reach equilibration for most passive samplers. And it's important to note that PEEPers provide a average concentration over the deployment time, so it's a time average concentration. Nice thing about PEEPers is they have a high vertical resolution. Our experience has been a very low potential for artifacts, One of the downsides is that you're working with relatively small sample volumes and you have the diffusion rate, which basically you have to wait at least 2 weeks to get your sample. Another limitation of these samples is prior to assembly and before deployment, they must be deoxygenated. Otherwise, you're going to have problems with artifacts when you deploy them. When these are removed from the sediment, they need to be sampled immediately and preserved with a suitable acid, depending on the metals that you're looking at. So on this slide here, I have two drawings of peepers. The one on the left is a design that's about can be up to a meter and a half overall, and it has cells throughout its vertical length that are capped with your dialysis membrane. These are filled with DI water and generally stored in a container with, as I mentioned, deaerated, deionized water prior to insertion. So with this rod type of design, basically it's just hammered down into your sediment and allowed to sit there for 2 weeks before removal. On the right side is a Hessline sampler, which was really the original peeper design. You see vertically there are a number of different channels that are grooved into this generally polycarbonate or some type of acrylic design. There's a removable faceplate here under which the sheet of dialysis membrane is placed. These are deployed much in the same way, hammered down to sediment, removed, and when they are removed for sampling, we generally rinse them off with deionized, deaerated water, remove all sediment particles, and then with a small pipette, you pierce each chamber and remove your sample and put that into a acid-stripped container. And our practice is to generally preserve these with 1 microliter of concentrated acid per mil of pore water. As I mentioned, Rhizone sampler is relatively new. I haven't had the opportunity to use these yet, but they're a microfiltration membrane that has a hydrophilic membrane that has a nominal pore size of around a tenth of a micron, which is at the bottom of the sampler tip. And basically, these are just inserted into sediment. I would allow some time to allow them to seal with the sediment interface. And then pore water is simply collected by applying a vacuum from either a syringe or a vacuum pump. Because this is actually a real size photo, they're about 6 inches long, you can do high resolution spatial sampling. And they provide a minimal disturbance of soils or sediment. Now, you can't really do much in the way of vertical sampling with these. However, if you did do sediment cores, you would be able to drill your core and insert these along a vertical axis and do vertical profiling. Next is the Henry sampler, which is a very simple device. It's basically a stainless steel tube with sampling slots that are cut into the bottom few inches of this stainless steel tube. Once inserted in the sediment, a vacuum hose is attached to the tube to either a syringe or a vacuum pump, and you collect your pore water. There's a lot of attractive features to the Henry samplers. They provide minimum disturbance. You can do some limited profiling at your site. There's really very little in the way of moving parts with the Henry sampler. They're reusable between sites and allow you to recycle them between sites relatively rapidly. They're inexpensive and fast. One limitation, however, is that your sampling volume is going to be limited. And I believe I have a drawing on the next page. And as you can see, on the right side, they're just very simple slots that are just large enough to keep most sediments from entering the tube. The tube is press down to desired depth and sediment. It has a stabilizing plate or collar that allows you to drive down to your desired depth. And then once in position, you can pull out your pour water with either a pump syringe, a syringe, or a vacuum pump. So now I'm going to talk about suction lysimeters. Like I said, these have a long history in agricultural and terrestrial applications. And basically, it's a plastic cylinder with a porous ceramic end cup. And this end cup is what admits pour water to the tube interior. So basically, to deploy these samplers, you dig a hole and you seal them in the ground, especially around the ceramic end cup, using a bentonite clay seal. And it has a little latex hose at the top, which you take a hand-operated vacuum pump and apply a vacuum to. These historically have been used for soil nutrients, agricultural chemicals, and other dissolved ions. Now, once you apply the vacuum to this cup, it slowly comes back and wants to equilibrate to atmospheric pressure, and you generally get a collection period of around 2 to 3 days. Samples are exposed to air during the collection period, so it may not be suitable for metals, but like I said, I wanted to throw these out here in case people were working upland or had other applications for sampling pour waters for other than metals. And on the left side of the slide, you see the traditional lysimeter, the ceramic cup at the bottom, and just the little inset there shows you that you just excavate a simple hole and with bentonite clay seal that end cup and basically backfill the rest and apply a vacuum. On the right side is a newer design soil lysimeter, and these actually get buried in the ground, and I believe you can apply a vacuum to them and you can remove pore water without actually removing them from the soil. So something to keep in mind if you are actually working at unique sites, something to consider. So now I'm going to move on to ex situ external samplers. These basically revolve around collecting bulk sediments, and two major categories are either sediment cores or grab samplers. I've done both. I highly prefer sediment cores. They really limit potential artifacts due mainly to oxidation. They can be taken on land or water. And once collected, they're easy to handle and store. You can collect large volumes of pore water from sediment cores. As I mentioned, sample handling can affect the data quality. It is critical that you consider time, temperature, and potential oxidation as important handling factors to consider when you're working with any type of ex situ sediment collection. So here I have a picture of a simple push corer. They're very simple to use. They can be used on land or in shallow water or by a scuba diver in deeper water. They're quick and relatively inexpensive to use. You do get a sample that has a vertical profile, but you can, depending on your needs, you can extrude them and composite your sample if vertical profiling is not an issue. There are some limitations. They do work better on finer grain, better sorted sediments. So, real rocky sediments are not indicated for a lot of push coring unless you have a core of a suitable diameter. And as I mentioned with coring, my experience has been that there's a lot lower potential for potential artifacts than other collection methods, which I'll just get into. Here is a gravity corer. This is something that you would use from a boat to sample sediments that are at depth that you may not be able to access with a diver or may not want to. Relatively easy to use, rapid deployment and recovery. As with the other sediment cores, you get samples with a vertical profile if it's desired. With these devices, a sediment core sleeve is on the inside, so it isolates the sediment from any potential metal contamination. And again, depending on where you're collecting sediments, performs best on fine grain sediments. So if sediment cores are not a viable method for you, or you need larger amounts of sediment, grab samplers are really your next choice. There are a multitude of them. I have two here, the common Van Veen and Ponar grabs. Van Veens generally come in a range of sizes, as do Ponars. So they can be hand deployed off something as small as a canoe or a rowboat, and larger ones are actually can be deployed off a larger boat with a overhead hoist or a A-frame. Once you've gone into the world of bulk sediment collection by these methods, you have to look into how you're going to extract your pore waters. The first method I'm going to talk about is sediment squeezing. It's a very simple technique. After you've collected your sediment and you've started handling it, you take a aliquot of your sediment, and depending on the size of your sediment squeezer, you place it into a cylinder that's generally sandwiched between Teflon or titanium discs and filter membranes. The mechanism of action for this is a moving piston which compresses the sediment and displaces pore water from the sediment. They're either mechanically or pneumatically operated to compress the sediment. Some of the downsides of these are limited volume of pore water produced, and the preparation can be time-consuming, and my concerns with these have been that you may get artifact generation based on the amount of time it takes to prepare one of these squeezers for operation. So I have two general depictions of squeezers. The one on the left, as you can see, there's a piston with cylinder with a number of different type discs that are porous, along with a filter membrane and your sediment puck, which is in the center. The one on the left side basically is mechanically operated, so you put it in some kind of press. The pore water exits through the bottom directly into a syringe, which is a good thing. The one on the right side is a older design, and basically is also mechanically squeezed. The water actually exits through this hose here, and I've never used this type, but it, just based on the way it produces the pore water, I wouldn't really recommend it for operation. And finally, the Rehberg squeezer. These have been used in oceanographic applications. These have often been set up in parallel on a manifold. And similar operation uses rubber membranes and filter discs and air pressure to separate your pore water from the sediment. Just due to the complex technical nature of assembling these with your sediment, I'm not really a big advocate of squeezing sediments for pore water. So the other major method for pore water extraction ex situ is centrifugation. This is really the method that we've used historically in our lab when we've needed large volumes of pore water, whether for testing or for toxicity tests. As I mentioned, depending on how much sediment you collect, you can generate large volumes. Sediments are loaded in centrifuge tubes. Generally recommend polyethylene or Teflon. They come in a range of sizes depending on how much pore water you desire to generate. Depending on grain size of your sediment will ultimately determine how much pore water you generate, but you spin down, there's a supernatant. Before I run pore water extractions by this method, I recommend sealing your tubes with inert gas and keep them at 4 degrees C during the extraction. As soon as our pore water is generated, and after the centrifuge comes down, we use a inline filtering system with a syringe to remove our pore water. When you're handling these samples prior to preparation and insertion into centrifuge and afterwards, I highly recommend using a glove bag or a glove box with an inert atmosphere to prevent artifact generation during this. Another important consideration is holding times. For this, I would not recommend holding a sediment any more than 24 hours and would really recommend doing your spin down and pore water isolation as soon as you can possibly do so. So preservation of pore waters, as I mentioned already, post-extraction pore water should be filtered immediately, 0.45 micron or better filter, depending on how you want to operationally define it. We use PET-lastic disposable acid strip syringes with an inline filter. If you spin down your pore water and you get a very clear supinatant, then your inline filters should work really very well. Depending on the metals that you're interested in, or if you're doing something outside of metals, there are a range of different membranes for syringe filters. And as I mentioned previously, once you get your pore water isolated, should be preserved with acid. General rule of thumb is 1 microliter per mil of either HCl or nitric acid, depending on the elements being measured. So just to summarize, there are a host of different methods that exist for isolating the pore water from sediments. Based on your site considerations and your data quality objectives and needs, that's going to really drive what method you select. My personal preference is for passive sampling peepers. You get great information when they're done properly. I have very high confidence in the data that's generated. Next in line, Henry samplers. In many cases, you get ability to rapidly collect samples and great spatial coverage. And then centrifugation. If you need large method, large volumes of pore water, that is the way to go. So select your methods carefully. Working within your budget, and really with sample collection and handling, I know I've hit on this, but I can't overemphasize, really the path to measuring pore waters accurately is to really be careful on how you sample and do everything on a timely basis, as temperature and oxidation are critical factors that are going to affect your pore water metal concentrations. And I guess we're going to hold questions to the end, so I'm all set, Mike.
Okay, actually, is that the way you wanted to hold them all the way to the end?
No, I thought that was, I'd be glad to take questions now if that's how you want to do it.
Let's take a few questions now.
Okay, great.
I think we're going to have plenty of time at the end for people to think of some more.
Okay.
Real quick, while the people on the phone lines are thinking of their questions, and if there are anybody on the phone lines, you need to press #6 to unmute. What is, you use the acronym RPD.
Yes.
What does that stand for?
Okay, that's redox potential discontinuity, and that's a vertical condition in a sediment, and it varies depending on what the redox condition is. But basically, it's a transition from where you have oxidized sediment to where you're going to a reduced environment. And it's very important as far as the metals chemistry goes, because you will see different binding phases in a oxic sediment responsible for holding metals out of solution. When you pass across that RPD boundary to a reduced anoxic condition, then different sediment phases, such as sulfides, become the predominant binding phase responsible for holding metals out of solution.
Good, thanks. I think there's probably a healthy number of people in the audience who thought it might have been, you know, relative percent difference and were a bit confused.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. The are there anybody on the phone lines with question? Okay, I think we've got a couple chemistry questions here. One about manganese.
Okay.
And the question is, have you looked at systems where manganese oxyhydroxides or phosphates, those impacts have been measured for solvated metal concentration?
I've measured manganese in the pore water, but I have not done that. And I guess, you know, one of the main reasons is that in a lot of the sediments that we work with and relative to crustal abundances, the iron oxyhydroxides are so much higher in concentration than the manganese that that is basically why I really haven't done much work with that.
Okay, and I have another sort of sampling and chemistry question here. How do you take into account metals that form hydroxycolloids at neutral pHs? In other words, they're not bound to the sediment, that are filtered out through the 0.45 micron filter.
Okay, so let me repeat that question. How do I take into account colloidal metals that have been possibly filtered out through...
hydroxycolloids at neutral pH that are filtered out at the 45 micron or the 0.45 micron filter.
Okay. To date, we haven't. I have not taken those into account. You know, basically, just a straight operational definition, which we take. You know, which I mentioned earlier, taking into account. We have done colloidal metal research, but not really to any great extent with sediment interstitial waters.
Okay. I have a general question regarding sampling. I think this question involves the analysis after you've been using the samplers.
Okay.
The question is, are there any pre-screening tools for on-site testing similar to how XRF is used in dry soil? Would pre-screening tools be useful for on-site characterization of contaminated sediment?
Okay. Well, I mean, I think XRF is great, you know, for bulk sediment. As far as I know, there's really no methods that could be used for screening pore waters out in the field, easily. I think it's something that you're going to have to do a laboratory-based instrumentation measurement on, using either ICP or flameless AA or ICP-MS, or ion-specific electrode if you have a specific particular metal that is supported by a ion-specific electrode, then that is possibly something that you could do out in the field. And that would, I know they're available for silver, and I don't know if they're available for cadmium or not, but those are two elements that you could potentially screen out in the field using a ISE.
Thanks. And I know there's always development on those too, so, I mean, in the future, I would imagine that there'll be more of those available for specific purposes. And the next question goes back to the peepers.
Yes.
And you describe that they need to be deoxygenated.
Yes.
And the question is, how are the peepers deoxygenated, and how is this condition preserved prior to deployment?
Okay, that's a great question. The peeper construction, or like the big ones that I showed you, and there are small ones, and I should really preface my remark. A peeper is anything. It could be a glass scintillation or a polyethylene scintillation vial that simply has a membrane over the open end and bend them. And for in-house sediment tests that we've done over the years for criteria development and such, when we want to assess sediment equilibration, we've basically buried things like this along with a cable tie in the sediment and allowed them to equilibrate. These more sophisticated vertical samplers, because they are plastic, you want to make sure that there's no molecular oxygen associated with them. And basically the way we do that is we take buckets of DI water and basically using, I think currently we use argon to displace any of the oxygen in the water, and at assembly time we use this deaerated water to assemble them. And if we're going out in the field, then we can put these samplers in either, depending on how long the sampler is that we're using, we can actually keep them in a bucket or a container or seal them in plastic with what we call DDIW, deaerated deionized water, in there so the oxygen-free environment is preserved.
Okay. And another peeper question here.
Sure.
Is the peeper incubation period 14 days regardless of the water temperature?
I would say approximately. We've done extensive testing because of all the contaminated sediment work that we've done here. At about 10 degrees C or so, I think we've always seen around 14 days equilibration. We're fortunate here because we work in a lot of marine systems. So if you know the salinity of your pore water, you can sacrifice a peeper and check the salinity of your pore water and determine whether or not it's come to equilibration. I understand that that's not an option for folks that are working in fresh water. But depending on your site, it's pretty close to 14 days. If you're unsure or if things are colder, then maybe if things are happening slower, you might want to maybe go a little bit longer.
Okay. And a clarification on just what the peepers are measuring. The question is, when you say that metals concentration in peeper cells that have equilibrated are actually average concentrations, do you mean average over a daily basis or averaged over the entire equilibration period?
Right. Yeah, it's a time average concentration over the entire. It has over the length of the deployment period.
Okay. A question, in general, about regarding the homogeneity of the sediments, and the question is, how spatially and temporally stable are pore water concentrations, especially when the overlying surface waters may have variable pH, ORP, dissolved oxygen, etc.?
That's a great question, and I think on one of the earlier slides I had talked about physical factors driving the status of pore water. And that's, I think, really a site-specific question, depending on your site location. Do you have a deep water quiescent location of fine-grained sediment that doesn't get resuspended? You might expect to see, because it's not likely to be disturbed on relatively frequent time scales, that you may see better spatial and temporal uniformity, but that's that's a total site specific question that really, I think, you have to really go on site, and that's one of the values of deploying peepers spatially simultaneously.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Mark. We've got some more questions for you, but we're going to go ahead and move on, and we'll save the questions until the after Chris's presentation.
Very good.
Okay. So today's second presenter is Chris Exley. And Chris received his BS in environmental science from Western Washington University and subsequently worked as a biological technician for the U.S. National Park Service for the next 4 years at Olympic National Park in Washington. In 2001, he began doing mercury research as a part of his MS at Trent University in Ontario, Canada, and has been actively engaged in mercury research ever since. His research focused on utilizing mercury-stable isotopes as tracers of methylation activity in lakes across Canada and the U.S. He received his Ph.D. in physical geography from the University of Toronto and focused on the influence of urban environments on mercury cycling. Subsequently, his two postdoctoral positions at the University of Nevada, Reno, and Environment Canada focused on identifying non-point sources of mercury emissions from active industrial mining and smelting sites. Dr. Eckley started working at EPA Region 10 in 2011. He's a mining geochemist in the Office of Environmental Assessment. His current work is split between working on Superfund site projects and reviewing environmental impact statements for newly proposed mines. Chris?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks for the introduction there, and thanks for everyone who organized this webinar series. I appreciate the opportunity to give the presentation. So this talk that I'm going to be giving is going to be a case study where we used some of the techniques that Mark talked about and the case studies from Black Butte Mine Superfund site in Oregon. And I'd like to acknowledge our project collaborators and funders at the Office of Research and Development, the National Risk Management Research Lab, Todd Buxton and John McKernan, and a bunch of other folks from Region 10 have also helped out on this project as well. So I will give a background on methylmercury, because the focus of our study was on mercury methylation, and so I give some background on just the basics of methylmercury in the environment and how it's created, and then we'll focus the rest of the talk on the Black Butte Mine Superfund site and the study that we're focused on in the reservoir that's downstream of that, and I'll focus in on some of the pore water methodology that we used, and I mentioned there on the outline that we talk about the successes and failures, and hopefully that'll be useful for other folks that are interested in doing these sort of measurements to see what sort of worked in our site conditions and what didn't work. And then I'll provide some initial results and emphasis on initial. This study that I'm presenting data from just wrapped up, about a month ago, and we just got some of the results back that I'll be presenting in this presentation a few weeks ago. So it's still an ongoing effort to sort of synthesize all the data from this, but it's been going on for 2 years, so I have a fair amount of initial results that I'll be discussing here so far. So I'll start out with just general information on mercury and methylmercury in the environment. In general, mercury is released in inorganic form, and that holds true whether it's from a coal-fired power plant or whether it's from an abandoned mine site. However, almost all human exposure to mercury comes from the consumption of fish, and the form of mercury in the fish is methylmercury. And often, the fish with high levels of methylmercury are located at long distances from where the initial source was. And so you have this pretty big disconnect between the form of mercury that's released and the form of mercury that people are exposed to. And so then in order to link these and to understand those relationships, we need to understand how mercury is transported in the environment, how it's transformed, specifically how it becomes methylated, how it becomes methylmercury, and how it bioaccumulates up the food web. Right below that arrow there is a kind of simplified schematic of a mercury cycle in a lake. And as you can see, there's a lot of arrows showing a lot of transformations of mercury in the environment. And it's important to understand all of those different processes in a lake, because those are really the factors that are going to be controlling how much methylmercury ends up in the fish. And it's not uncommon to have lakes that are right next to each other that have very similar inputs of inorganic mercury, but very different amounts of methylmercury that accumulate in the fish. And the reason is because there's different processes in each lake in terms of the transformation of mercury as well as the bioaccumulation. So some of the variables that influence mercury methylation. Mercury is methylated by aerobic bacteria in oxygen-free environments, and it's mostly sulfate-reducing bacteria that are responsible for methylation. However, iron reducers also can participate in mercury methylation as well, but in general, it's mostly the sulfate reducers. The methylation occurs in sediment as well as in anoxic water column, and this diagram here on the side shows the microbial layer and where it's located in lakes with and without an anoxic hypolimnion. You can see that if the lake stratifies and becomes anoxic, then you can get the bacterial community moving into the water column. But in most systems, if you have oxygenated water, then the methylation happens right in that sediment layer right below the oxygenated water. And I'll point out that the bacteria that are involved in the methylation tend to like that transition zone between oxic and anoxic conditions, and so they usually occur in a pretty thin zone. That microbial layer that's involved in methylation can usually be just a couple centimeters thick. Now, only a small fraction of the sediment mercury is bioavailable for methylation, and this is sort of the justification as for why it's important to do measurements of pore water. So here we can see this is sort of a depiction of sediment, and the space in between it would be the pore water. So if you have mercury in the sediment, that is not going to be available for the bacteria doing the methylation. It's only the mercury that partitions away from the sediment and into the pore water will be available to the bacteria. And it's not all of the mercury that partitions into the pore water that will be available. It's a smaller subset here, and this is there's different theories on which forms of mercury are available to the bacteria. Some people think that it's mostly by passive diffusion, but there's also some thought that it could be some active uptake by the bacteria as well. But regardless of the sort of conceptual model and how the mercury gets methylated, everyone agrees that it's only a small portion of the mercury that's dissolved within the pore water that is available for methylation. And so you really have two factors that are dictating how much methylmercury ends up getting produced. One is how much of that mercury associated with the sediment is dissolved into the dissolved into the pore water and is in a biologically available form. And then the other factor that affects how much methylmercury you get is the abundance of the methylating bacteria. And of course, the bacteria are going to be impacted by the amount of dissolved organic carbon and sulfate in the system. So in theory, you can have a system with a lot of mercury in the pore water, but if you don't have the bacteria there, then you're not going to get much methylmercury production. Conversely, you could have a system with a lot of bacteria, but not much mercury in the pore water, and then you wouldn't have much methylmercury. So, and then, of course, if you have a lot of the bacteria and a lot of mercury in the pore water, then you're going to have a hot spot of methylmercury production. All right, so now focusing in on our particular study site here, it's the Black Butte Mine Superfund site. It was historically a mining cinnabar, which is mercury sulfide, at the site, and it operated from 1890 until the 1960s. And ore was processed on site, and so you have tailings materials from the ore processing located on the surface of the site, and it's located in Oregon, just south of Eugene. I think I originally had a star on this map, but it's not showing up there, but that's all right. I'll zoom in on a sort of schematic of what the site looks like here. I'll grab that arrow. Yeah, there we go. So here's the site where the green arrow is, and you can see that you have a couple streams that are draining the site, and you have tailings that are located right along the streams, and in some cases the streams flow right over the top of the tailings. And that area there is involved in a separate work that I'm not going to be presenting on here, but we are studying export during storm events and during base flow conditions from the mine site itself. And from that information, we know that most of the mercury that's being exported from the site is in the inorganic form, which is not particularly surprising. And then the mercury flows downstream, and the distance between the mine site and this reservoir down here is about 15 kilometers. And it flows through a sort of seasonally inundated wetland area and then gets deposited in this reservoir. And the reservoir has elevated concentrations of methylmercury in the fish. And it's the reservoir was the first site within Oregon that had a fish consumption advisory, which occurred back in 1979 because of methylmercury levels in the fish there. And most of the fish in the reservoir above the 0.3 micrograms per gram, kind of national guideline, but it's not uncommon to find fish that are up to 2 micrograms per gram, so they're quite elevated. And the focus of this talk is going to be on the dynamics that create methylmercury in the reservoir. They're downstream of the mine. So in the big picture, the questions that we need to understand at this site is linking that inorganic mercury that's being released from the site to the methylmercury that is eventually accumulating in the fish. And so these are kind of the sub-questions within that we're addressing. What are the variables that are controlling methylmercury production? Is it being controlled more by the presence of the bacteria, by the sulfate and the dissolved organic carbon, or is it being affected by the availability of inorganic mercury at the site? Where is the methylmercury produced? Is it being produced more within the watershed, or is it being produced within the water column or the sediment at the site? And what is the source of the inorganic mercury that's being methylated? What's the relative importance of new releases of mercury from the mine versus the historic releases from the mine? If we think about the mine, operating up until the 1960s, clearly there is a lot of historic mercury that's entered into the reservoir that remains in the reservoir. And every year we continue to get new releases of mercury coming into the reservoir, but those are very small compared to the legacy mercury in the site. And so it's important to understand the relative bioavailability of the new versus the old mercury to try and understand where to best focus remediation options at the site. And finally, we can't ignore that mercury is deposited from the atmosphere, just from the global pool of mercury. There's reservoirs and lakes that are located in remote areas without a mercury mine upstream that can still have levels of mercury in the fish that are above safe consumption levels. So the atmospheric deposition at every site for mercury is always something that needs to be taken into consideration. So the specific question that we're going to focus on in this talk here is identifying the influence of reservoir water level changes on methylmercury production. And this question is not unique to this particular site, but these dynamics are very important, we think, at this location. It's been identified in numerous studies that reservoirs tend to have higher levels of mercury in fish than natural lakes and rivers. And one of the ideas one of the causes for that might be that you have enhanced methylation in the sediments when you have this water level changes. And so we wanted to study this dynamic at our site. And this schematic here shows the theory behind this. So if we predominantly have sulfate-reducing bacteria involved in the methylation, at some point, those bacteria may run out of sulfate. And when they're using the sulfate, they're creating sulfide as the byproduct. Once they've exhausted the sulfite, then the sulfur-reducing bacteria will become dormant, and methanogens will take over. And at that point, methylmercury production may decrease or may cease to exist. then, in this scenario, once you decrease the water level, you have this sediment with all of this sulfide that's been built up in the sediment, and it gets exposed to the air, and that sulfide reoxidizes back into sulfate. And then when you raise the water level again, you have an increased level of sulfate in the sediment, and that could potentially promote more sulfur-reducing bacteria populations and increase the amount of methylmercury being produced. So that's the theory that we're kind of testing at this site on why this reservoir might have elevated levels of methylmercury. So our methods that we use is we measured seasonally. So we were out there during all four seasons, and we're taking surface water measurements, sediment core measurements, and pore water measurements. And the pore water measurements, we attempted to, as I mentioned earlier, this is a two-year study. We spent most of the first year trying to get pore water measurements, but we're not successful in getting much data from that. So most of our pore water measurements come from the second year of the study, and I'll go through some of the variables that we ran into that complicated getting the pore water measurements during that first part of the study. And I'll also mention that we didn't just measure total mercury and methylmercury, but in order to understand what are the controlling variables on methylation, then we also measured dissolved organic carbon, sulfate, sulfide, and a couple other parameters at the site to understand these dynamics. And our rationale for doing pore water here was that the pore water mercury is going to be the more bioavailable form of mercury for methylation. The trends in mercury and methylmercury in pore water will be different than what we'd see if we just measured bulk sediment. The pore water methylmercury is more available for benthic invertebrate uptake, and the pore water methylmercury is that's the mercury that's going to be able to diffuse into the overlying water and ultimately get into the aquatic food chain there. So all the folks that were working on this project were fairly new to pore water measurements for mercury and methylmercury. And so we started out by doing a literature review on all the different techniques that were available to us that other people had used for mercury and methylmercury pore water measurements. And this is a very small list of the different papers that have come out. There's been a lot of other people that have worked on this stuff over the years besides these folks, but this is just an example of some papers on this topic. And I think all of these different methods, Mark gave a nice overview of them in his talk. The ones that we specifically tested here are the ones that I just highlighted in green there, the piezometer Henry sampler method, core squeezing, and the centrifuge infiltration method. The reason that we didn't go for the passive sampler technique, either the peepers or DGTs, which are the diffusive gradient in thin films, is because they require a dive team to deploy them. While Region 10 has a dive team that we could use for this, our field site is located about 5 or 6 hours from our office, and it just increases the number of people involved and the cost if you have to employ a dive team in order to do the measurements. So we thought at first cut we would try and do these measurements that we could do without deploying divers, and if they didn't work, then eventually would call on the dive team for help. Also, with doing the passive sampler technique, you know, they're being installed and then they have to be retrieved a couple weeks later, so you're ultimately having two field sample mobilizations, whereas if you can go down and just collect the core, you know, with the core squeezing technique or Henry sampler, then you're only doing that on one trip. And also with the passive samplers, you're getting a time-integrated measurement, which has a lot of benefits for some research questions. But for our specific question, where we wanted to look at seasonal variability, we ultimately were more interested in getting a snapshot of conditions at one point in time as opposed to that integrated signal. So here's sort of a depiction of the piezometer Henry sampler method that we deployed. And you kind of have this weight on the top, and we were sending this down over the side of the boat, you know, with the sample line hooked up to pump water up from the piezometer. And what we ran into here, and we did a couple dye tests with this in the laboratory setting, is that we kept getting overlying water creeping into the sediment and showing up in our sample. And I think that this would work better if you're interested in taking measurements deeper within the sediment. However, for our study question, we were interested in that 0 to 2 or 0 to 4 centimeter interval, so very, very shallow sediment. And when you're going to be sucking water that close to the sediment-water interface, you're likely to run into problems with getting some overlying water mixed into your piezometer. And there's definitely folks that have been able to do this successfully, but we were not able to, and so we moved to doing different techniques. We also tried the pore water squeezing method that Mark also mentioned. And we have really fine sediments at our site, and so we kept getting our filters would clog after we were able to filter through about 5 or 10 milliliters of sample, and then we'd have to switch out the filters. And so we became concerned about how many filters we were switching through in order to get ultimately we needed about 200 milliliters of volume in order to do all of the analysis for our different samples. And so besides being time consuming, particularly for the mercury samples, we had to run that pore water through 5 to 10 different filters, and each time you're getting perhaps a little bit of contribution of mercury from the filter. And so our field blanks were pretty high using this technique. And so ultimately we decided that this wasn't working out that well for us. Also, when you're putting pressure on the core, you're getting flow of pore water within that core system. And it's really hard then to isolate specific depth intervals, at least using the technique that we work, because we were interested in isolating 0 to 2 centimeters from 2 to 4 centimeters, so on and so forth. Also, because we were doing this work outside of an anoxic glove bag, we were worried about oxidation of redox-sensitive species during this process. So what we ultimately ended up using, and we ended up doing this during our second year of the study, and I'll show some results from this, was the centrifuge/filtration method. And this had the benefit of being able to really isolate near-surface samples and get those discrete intervals. And we did this within anoxic glove chambers, and so we were able to maintain the redox conditions. And I'll just walk through some of the steps that were involved in collecting these cores. So here we're using, Mark showed pictures of the gravity cores to collect the cores, so that's what we're using here. We're sending down a gravity core and collecting these core tubes. And in order to get our 200 milliliters of volume for the different parameters that we're going to get measured, we ended up having to collect about eight sediment cores in order to composite those, in order to get enough pore water volume. And then we did cutting of the slicing up of the cores within an anoxic glove bag. And of course, Mark mentioned this in his presentation also, these you want to process these pretty rapidly after they've been collected. You don't want to freeze them and mail them off to a lab and have them thawed and then analyzed later. You want to do these pretty quick, which requires bringing along a mobile lab if you're not located near, if your lab space is located far away from where you're collecting them. In our instance, we're like over 5 hours away from our kind of home lab, and so we bring down a mobile lab to do all this work in. And then you do the centrifuging, and this here is an example of a time when it didn't separate that well. So sometimes you can either recentrifuge or you can pour off the top water and centrifuge again. And then after you've centrifuged, you pour off that top water. Here we are doing this again within an anoxic glove chamber, and located right below the filter there is the pour water that we ended up doing. And here we have several filtration units set up at the same time, so we can just increase our throughput and increase the number of samples that we can get. So now moving on from the method section on to some of the results. The first thing I'll show here is some data that this incorporates some the data that the EPA did in the lake, as well as some work that the USGS did upstream and downstream of the reservoir. And so we're showing here on the y-axis the percent methylmercury, which is the amount of methylmercury divided by the total mercury, to show the methylation potential within the system. And what we see is that compared to the inflow or upstream water from the reservoir, which is on that gray line there, we have a much higher percent methylmercury in the outflow water as well as in the reservoir. And essentially what that tells us is it helps answer that question of where is methylation occurring within this system. And it looks to us that methylmercury is being produced within the reservoir itself. And now moving on to some of the sediment core data. Here we have along the y-axis the sediment core depth. We've cut the sediment core into four different increments shown there. And then this is the mercury concentration in each one of those increments. And this is looking at the total mercury concentration. And you can see we have these different field sites. We have the site here in this solid blue area, which is our permanently inundated part of the lake, which is covered with water year-round. And then we have these in this dotted area, those three sites. And those are seasonally inundated with water. Sometimes they're dry and sometimes they're wet. And so if we look at the total mercury concentration, you can see there's not a lot of difference in the concentration with sediment core depth, and that the highest concentrations are in those the central locations within the reservoir there. And now looking at the methylmercury, we see a very different situation. With the exception of that central core site, you definitely see an increase in the methylmercury produced in the top 2 centimeters of the sediment core, and we also see that the sites with the highest amount of methylmercury are the seasonally inundated locations that are subjected to those water level changes. And if we then look at the percent methylmercury, it's even more clear that those sites that experience water level fluctuations have the most methylation potential occurring at them. So overall, it looks like the influence of water level fluctuations is increasing mercury methylation occurring at that site. Now this is moving on to some of the results from the second year of our study. Here we've added a handful of more locations, specifically in the wetland areas of the reservoir, to understand the potential for methylation in those environments. And this data here is some of the pore water sulfate measurements. So we got pore water sulfate there on the y-axis, and then these are 10 different sample locations, and there's 10 different dots there on the map. And I'm showing this data from the spring and the summer for the sulfate, and you can see that pretty much at all the sites you see this decrease in sulfate levels from the spring to the summer, indicating that you do have active sulfate reduction occurring at the site. And then if you add on this showing where this data is coming from, this is the permanently inundated site, so it's year-round covered with water, and it had some of the lower, was lower than most of the other sites in terms of the sulfate concentrations. And so it seemed that those sites that were seasonally varying water levels had increased levels of sulfate compared to the permanently inundated site, which helps support our theory that those water level fluctuations are increasing sulfate in the sediments. And here we're looking at the sediment methylmercury concentration versus sediment total mercury concentration. You can see there's a fair amount of scatter in this data at the high concentration. So if we look at sort of the trends here, it looks like we kind of have this linear trend as the concentrations are less than 1,000 nanograms, and then as you get to the higher concentrations, that sort of linearity drops off. And this has important implications for the remediation of the site. For example, if you're up in this higher concentrations, if you decrease the mercury concentration by 50% from, say, 1,400 down to about 700 nanograms per gram, you might not see much difference in methylmercury in the site, because some of that mercury at those higher concentrations might not be biologically available. Conversely, if you were to reduce the concentration from 600 down to 300, you might get a 50% reduction in the total mercury. You might see a similar 50% reduction in the methylmercury. So depending on where you are in this curve, you might get a one-to-one response in reductions in methylmercury, or you might not. So it's important to understand where you are in terms of that relationship between total mercury and methylmercury to understand how much mercury you need to remediate at a site and what sort of response you might get. All right, I've just got a couple more slides here. This shows the total mercury concentration in the sediment and the total mercury concentration in the pore water, which is showing the partitioning of mercury from the sediment to the pore water. And we can see very linear at the lower concentrations. Then when you get to that higher mercury concentration sediment, you see a decrease in the partitioning. So that mercury in the sediment that's the most contaminated is locked up pretty strongly in the sediment and is not partitioning into the water where it could become available. Now, when we look at the pore water total mercury concentration versus pore water methylmercury concentration, then we see it's much more linear, and we see then that it sort of confirmed our thinking that the sediment inorganic mercury that's in the pore water phase that's really available for methylmercury production. Now, conclusions, collecting the pore water can be very labor and resource intensive, but it can also provide important information for the site management. And the trends that we see in the total mercury and methylmercury in the sediment phase are different than what we see in the pore water phase. So the mercury methylation also is influenced by the water level fluctuations, and this appears to be due to enhanced sulfate cycling due to that water level changes. And the partitioning of mercury, the total mercury from the sediment into the pore water affects methylmercury production, and that the total mercury in the most highly contaminated sediments appears to be less available for methylation, sorry about the spelling error there with four, than the mercury that's in the less contaminated sediment seems to be partitioning into the pore water at a higher rate and is more available for methylation. And with that, that's the last slide I have, and I'll leave it up to the moderator to take questions.
Thanks, Chris. And we do have a few questions here for you. I'll go ahead and ask the people if folks on the phone lines have questions for Chris, please unmute your phone. You can do that by pressing #6. So we do have some specific questions regarding the case study, and one of them is, in retrospect, would you have used a dive team if you had to do this again?
You know, I don't think we would, because ultimately we were able to get good measurements with collecting the sediment cores with the gravity core and then spinning them in the centrifuge and extracting the pore water that way. I think we could have gotten very similar results and just as good of results had we used a dive team and deployed peepers at the site or the DGTs. But I don't think it was ultimately necessary in order to get good pore water measurements in the end. I think we could achieve those without deploying the dive team at this site.
Okay. We had some questions about I guess the microbiology of the site. So did you not monitor the iron concentration since iron, but one participant mentioned that iron-reducing bacteria can also do methylation, so they were curious as to why iron was not monitored.
You know, we actually did measure iron too. Measurements as well. I just didn't present any of that data, but that is a good point that it's not solely sulfate-reducing bacteria involved in methylation, that there's also iron reducers as well, and we did take measurements for that. I just haven't presented it.
And you did you quantify sulfate-reducing bacteria?
Oh, sorry. We only were looking at sulfate-reducing bacteria and iron-reducing bacteria as the presence of sulfate and sulfide and changes in those, as well as the presence of reduced iron. In the system, we didn't make any measurements of the microbial communities directly.
Okay. As far as methylmercury goes, do you know if the tissue concentrations of methylmercury in fish are due primarily to methylation by sediment bacteria, or possibly by bacteria within the fish?
From my understanding, most of the methylmercury is produced within outside of the fish, and that internal methylmercury production within a fish would be pretty minor. Most of the mercury that the fish are getting they're picking it up through their diet, and it's bioaccumulating that way. And so most of the mercury would be methylated within the sediment or potentially within the water column and then accumulating in the fish that way.
And you mentioned that you had taken an upstream sample. Where was that taken?
It was taken, that measurement's upstream and downstream of the reservoir were actually collected by collaborators at the USGS. And there's a USGS gauging station a couple kilometers upstream of the reservoir. It's along the Coast Fork Willamette River. And it's the water that flows. It's the main inflow. There's several other smaller streams that enter the reservoir, but there's the main flow is coming from the Coast Fork Willamette River, and the sampling station there for the inflow measurements was just upstream of the reservoir.
Okay, thanks. The next question, was the mercury measured in the pore water, was it bioavailable, or was it bound to colloids?
Yeah, that's a good question. Presumably, most of that mercury that we measured in the most of the inorganic mercury that we measured within the pore water was not available for methylation. But because we saw a pretty good correlation between the pore water inorganic mercury and the pore water methylmercury, it was a pretty linear relationship when comparing just the pore water mercury concentrations. Even if it's a small subset of the total mercury that's in the pore water that is available for methylation, it seems to vary fairly linearly with the total mercury concentration in the sediment. So even though it's a small amount of that total that's probably biologically available, which we didn't measure, we just looked at the total amount of mercury in the pore water, but it seems to vary in a predictable fashion with the biologically available form.
Okay. Thanks. I'm not sure if this next question is regarding background. The question is, what methods are you using to distinguish between mercury from the mine versus atmospheric deposition?
Yeah, that's a good question. And at this point in the study, we're not making a distinction between those. It's really difficult to figure out what the source of that mercury is. Down the line, there has been talk about looking at stable isotope fractionation. within the system and seeing whether the mercury from the mine source has a distinct isotopic signature compared to atmospherically deposited mercury, but we haven't gotten into that yet. However, when we look at the concentrations in the sediment from streams that are not draining the mine site, and then we look at some of the sediment concentrations within the sediment in the reservoir, we can kind of get a sense of which sediments are impacted by the mine site just by looking at the total concentrations, because the rest of the watershed is quite pristine. There's not, from some of the other drainages coming in, you have quite low concentrations of mercury in the sediments. And so just by comparing those with what we're seeing in the sediment, we can tell that once you get into those higher concentrations, for example, some of the sediments that we're seeing, that the concentrations are over 1,000 nanograms per gram, those are clearly enriched compared to what we'd expect from a natural background site. So sort of without pinning it down too tightly, we can assume that those higher concentrations are attributed to the mine site. And that's about as far as we can take it at this point. In terms of figuring out then that mercury that's available for methylation, whether that mercury, that small subfraction of mercury that's getting methylated, is that coming from atmospheric sources or the mine sources, that's a really important question to tackle at the site, and we haven't been able to distinguish between those two at this point in the study, but that's something we'll definitely be looking into as we continue.
Okay. Thanks. We had a question regarding a clarification on some of the information you show on slide 19.
Okay.
And the question is...
Should I scroll back to that?
Sure.
Yeah.
The question is, why is the methylmercury concentration lower at higher concentrations than they are at lower concentrations?
That's one of the... And the answer to that is that... So this here we're looking at just the bulk sediment measurements, and this is really making the case for why it's important to look at pore water at a site, because here we see that at higher sediment concentrations, we're not seeing that continued linear response in methylmercury production, which is telling us that some of that mercury that's from the most contaminated sediments at the site is not in a biologically available form. And so you can increase the sediment concentration at those higher levels, but you're not getting a linear response in terms of methylmercury being produced at those sites. And then when we look at the next slide in the presentation, and we're looking at the partitioning of the total mercury from the sediment into the pore water with phase, we see that same relationship where that mercury at those higher concentrations is more tightly bound to the sediment itself and is not partitioning into the pore water where it could be available for methylation.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. I have a question on remediation, and you mentioned remediation implications from the methylmercury versus total mercury patterns. What types of remediation are being considered at the reservoir?
You know, at this point, we have not considered any remediation options at this site yet. The site is broken up into three operable units. There's operable unit one, which is the mine site proper, and then operable unit two, which is the river system connecting the mine site and the reservoir. Then the reservoir itself is operable unit three. Right now, all of the RIFS work in terms of figuring out different remediation options is focused directly on OU1 on the mine site itself. And eventually we'll move downstream and start thinking about remediation options within the reservoir, but we're not at that phase of the study yet. This work that we're doing here with ORD, with the ORD collaborators, is really outside of the direct RIFS work, where we're looking for remediation options at the site. So that wasn't really one of our objectives, and we haven't started to think about different scenarios in much detail in terms of what could be done. That said, one of the things that we think we see within the system is that methylmercury production is not occurring equally throughout the entire reservoir. When we look at some of those graphs back here, a few slides, we can just look at slide number 18, and we see that sediment methylmercury can be less than half a nanogram per gram to up to 3.5 nanograms per gram. So you have quite a bit of spatial variability, and it seems that these aren't plotted on a map that you can see where those particular dots are located, but the sites with the highest methylmercury production are occurring within those wetland areas as the water flows into the reservoir. And in theory, if you could target those specific areas for reduced methylmercury production, either by doing some sort of soil amendment or reducing water level fluctuations in that section of the reservoir, then you could probably get more methylmercury. You could get a fair amount of reduction in the amount of mercury being methylated. So that would be one of the outcomes of the study, is that we can show that methylmercury production is not happening equally throughout the entire reservoir, but you do have these hot spots of production, and targeting those areas for remediation options, you would be able to get kind of the most bang for your buck. So the study kind of points in that direction, but we haven't really looked at the feasibility of different remediation options in much detail at this point.
Thanks. I'm going to go ahead and hit the pause button on the Q&A session for a moment, and then we'll get back to you. So before we open the question and answer session to both presenters, I wanted to make sure everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely with the archive, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, we'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also in the related URLs pod, you'll be able to find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Links to the seminar resources and the seminar feedback form can also be found on the last slide of today's presentation. And a couple more announcements before we open up the Q&A session again. There is one more session in this series. Session 4 will be case studies, PSDs for organic contaminants, and it will be December 15th from 12:30 to 2:30 Eastern Time. So it's the same time window as today's seminar. More information and links to register can be found at the SRP webpage, which is go.usa.gov/VFJW. Stay up to date with the latest SRP news and events by following the SRP Twitter feed at SRP_NIEHS. So I guess now, if Mark is still with us, and Chris, if there's still questions, and if there's anybody on the phone who want, you know, you can hit #6 to go ahead and ask your question now. And we do have quite a few questions for both of you left over from the simulcast. Mark, are you still there?
I'm still here, Mike.
All right. I'm sorry, I was pausing here to wait to see if anybody would hop in on the phone lines, but I'm going to zip back to the questions as they came in at the end of Mark's presentation and the beginning of Chris's We did have a comment from somebody on the Henry sampler, and I don't know if you have any response to this. But the comment is, one advantage of the Henry sampler to hydrogeologists looking at groundwater, surface water discharge is that you can measure the head of the in the sediments versus the water level and get an idea of the rate of flux. Don't, if you don't have a response to that, I'd...
I imagine you can. For us, it's generally not a... consideration at the sites that we work with. Most of the pore waters I work with are in estuarine systems, so we haven't been able to make those kind of measurements anyway. So, but it is a point noted though, and a feature of the Henry sampler.
Okay. And the next question is about the filtering process. Is the filtering of pore water just for ex situ samples, or is that recommended for in situ samples as well?
If that's actually a pretty good question. For a high quality, or I'd say where you had a peeper that was well rinsed and everything looked like it should, I think you could, and what we've done historically is not refilter a peeper membrane, but that taken into effect if you have a lesson, if you have things that are stuck to the membrane and such, like we've had before, filtering would definitely be advised. If you have any question as to whether there may be some kind of artifacts or residues on the top of membranes, we have in some circumstances seen, I don't want to call it biofouling, but it may be biofouling on some of the membranes, and in a case like that, we would filter it.
Here's another question as far as sample prep goes. Why is centrifuge better than squeezing?
I guess at least with regard to my presentation,
I have
a bias towards centrifugation. Did try squeezing. Everything being equal, I think you can. I think there were just more moving parts, and to it that I was kind of being a former metals chemist, still paranoid about contamination, and I think just overall centrifugation is just there's less steps, it's straightforward and easier in my opinion.
Okay. Mark, I think this was still during your presentation. What is the best method to measure redox during the bioassay without disturbing the peepers?
Best method is, if you're measuring, sediment in situ, I think the best way is just, they have some very fine gauge redox probes, and I think you could get a relatively good or accurate redox measurement, without coming close enough to the probe where you would, interfere with the pore water exchange with the peeper. And that's what we've done, where we've had tests in place. We just basically sample an adjacent location of sediment and. Generally we've assumed that, there's, homogeneity there.
Okay, thanks. Comment, I think what they're trying to get at is, are there any specific considerations for sampling arsenic?
Not that I not that I know of, but I haven't worked with arsenic, so
okay.
I can't really speak to that. But I'm trying to think of you know, there are considerations to how you measure it once you've isolated it, but
mm-hmm.
with regard to field sampling, I can't really speak to that. I'm not even sure what acid you would want to preserve it with.
Okay, yeah, but the arsenic can be extracted by the peepers.
I would imagine so. Sure.
Okay.
If you find arsenic in the dissolved phase, I'm just I'm not right on top of the geochemistry and any potential. It's not straightforward like a lot of the our classic divalent metals that are readily form sulfide complexes. So I know it has a number of different speciation states. So and I just don't remember what it might want to bind to in the sediments offhand. But it should be measurable by peepers.
I had a question about sort of another control or sample prep question, and the question is, have you ever looked at loss of metals to the surfaces of the sampling equipment? In other words, have you looked at losses from a control sample?
We have done a number of manipulations. We do a lot of work. When we do this work with peepers, we do it in duplicate, and we do blanks and control sediments. But based on the materials that we use, we haven't done anything specifically like that. But I wouldn't expect any loss to plastic surfaces, which is what we use exclusively. But that being said, it could be something to check for. But most of the times, like when we're extracting our pore waters, we're concerned with making sure all the sediments and any kind of particulate matter are gone from the surface. So that being said, we haven't done anything to look at that.
Okay, thanks. I have a question here regarding the Rizon sampler.
Yes.
And the question is, dissolved metals are defined as passing through a 0.45 micron filter, yet nominal size on the Rizon is 0.12 to 0.17 microns. How do you account for the metals outside of this range?
Okay. Yeah, like I said, I think dissolved metals, that's kind of a, you have to, as I did in the presentation, I operationally defined it as 0.45, but there are peepers, the people that have used peepers that have used different membrane sizes. Do I think there's a lot, are there metals that are within that range? Yes, I'm not quite sure how much, but I put that out there mainly to show that there's an option there for different sampling technology, and I wouldn't be surprised if there were pore sizes that were different from what I had just shown there.
Thanks. Another question on types of passive samplers. Do you have any experience with a passive sampler that uses diffusion into a polymer rather than diffusion across a membrane into clean water?
No, I don't. I personally don't. There are a number of, DGE and DGT, diffusion gradient film passive samplers. We do extensive work with polymers for organic contaminants. We haven't worked on them to any extent here, and that's primarily because most of our work now with passive samplers is with organics. I am not current with what the state of development is with them. With looking at the literature recently, I think they were, still under development. I have one colleague, Jim Shine at Harvard University, that's been he's been working on a metal passive sampler. I believe they call them jellyfish. So they are a some type of polymer that gel that metals diffuse through to, but other than that, I'm not really I'm not doing any work with regard to those.
Thanks, Mark. I think we have a few questions here regarding Chris's presentation, but both of you are free to answer if you can add to the discussion. Although this first one I think is specific. So Chris, the question is, what about DOC in pore water? Was the percent mercury methylation correlated at all with the DOC? And I'm assuming that means dissolved organic.
Yeah. Was the dissolved organic carbon? That's a really good question. Unfortunately, I have not looked at that in much detail yet. When I ran some initial correlations with the data, I'll qualify all this by saying I got that data back from the lab about 2 weeks ago, so I just started playing around with some of that pore water methylmercury data. I did do a correlation with the methylmercury and DOC, and nothing initially jumped out. I might have to look at integrating over different depth intervals and or looking at just a subset of some sites, but at first glance, I didn't see a strong correlation between the DOC and the pore water and the methylmercury produced. However, as I look into that more in depth, that's definitely something that I'll look into. I think that when we look at our scatter in the plots of total mercury in the pore water versus methylmercury in the pore water, there's clearly some sites with that fall above and below that linear regression line between those two parameters. And I think that the sites where you have, above that line are probably ones that are higher in organic carbon and or sulfate. And the ones that are lower probably had lower DOC and sulfate. And probably the best way to do that is not to look at a singular relationship between just the DOC and the methylmercury, because of course the inorganic mercury concentration is also coming into play there. So I'd need to do some sort of multi-variable analysis to account for all those different factors. And after that's done, it wouldn't surprise me if I see a relationship with DOC and the methylmercury in the pore water, but that hasn't been completed at this point, unfortunately.
Thanks. Are you guys? Both might be able to comment on this, and this is the cost question. What is the cost differential between in situ and ex situ sampling?
At least in our study, everything we were doing was up on the boat, I think in terms of the costs, I think had we used the dive team to put in passive samplers, it would have increased the cost just in terms of the number of people involved in the project, and also the fact that we would have had to revisit the site twice per sampling event, once to deploy the samplers and once again to retrieve them. So I think that in terms of cost, doing the core collection and bringing it up to the surface and then centrifuging or squeezing or doing that sort of method would ultimately be a lower cost just in terms of the labor resources involved. Of course, when you're doing those measurements outside of the lake and the sediment, then there's the infrastructural costs of purchasing a centrifuge and having access to a mobile lab space and buying the anoxic glove chambers. And so part of the balancing the cost of those is, do you already have that equipment purchased already and at your disposal, or would you have to build that whole system for doing those measurements outside of the lake from scratch? And that would probably balance out the increased labor costs of sending divers down, I would think.
Thanks, Chris. I'm going to say that we do still have quite a few unanswered questions, and but I think it's about time to end the webinar today. If you have additional questions, you can contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN, which is linked to and from the SRP Risk E-Learning webpage. If you submitted an online question and did not have time, and we didn't have time to get to it, it will be forwarded to the presenters. I'd like to thank our presenters, Mark and Chris, today for their time preparing and for sharing their presentation. This concludes today's presentation. Thank you all for your participation.